Chapter 4. I had half a mind to ask him point blank whether he, at least, didn't know why Falk, a notoriously unsociable man, had taken to visiting his ship with such assiduity. After all, I reflected suddenly, it was a most remarkable thing. I wonder now what Herman would have said. As it turned out, he didn't let me ask. Forgetting all about Falk apparently, he started a monologue on his plans for the future. The selling of the ship, the going home, and falling into a reflective and calculating mood, he mumbled between regular jets of smoke about the expense. The necessity of disbursing passage money for all his tribe seemed to disturb him in a manner that was the more striking, because otherwise he gave no signs of a miserly disposition. And yet he fussed over the prospect of that voyage home in a mail boat like a sedentary grocer who has made up his mind to see the world. He was racially thrifty, I suppose, and for him there must have been a great novelty in finding himself obliged to pay for traveling, for sea traveling, which was the normal state of life for the family from the very cradle for most of them. I could see he grudged prospectively every single shilling which must be spent so absurdly. It was rather funny. He would become doleful over it, and then again, with a fretful sigh, he would suppose there was nothing for it now but to take 3 second-class tickets, and there were the 4 children to pay for besides. A lot of money, that, to spend at once. A big lot of money. I sat with him listening, not for the first time, to these heart searchings till I grew thoroughly sleepy, and then I left him and turned in on board my ship. At daylight I was awakened by a yelping of shrill voices, accompanied by a great commotion in the water, and the short, bullying blasts of a steam whistle. Falk with his tug had come for me. I began to dress. It was remarkable that the answering noise on board my ship together with the patter of feet above my head ceased suddenly. But I heard more remote guttural cries which seemed to express surprise and annoyance. Then the voice of my mate reached me howling expostulations to somebody at a distance. Other voices joined, apparently indignant. A chorus of something that sounded like abuse replied. Now and then the steam whistle screeched. Altogether that unnecessary uproar was distracting, but down there in my cabin I took it calmly. In another moment, I thought, I should be going down that wretched river, and in another week at the most I should be totally quit of the odious place, and all the odious people in it. Greatly cheered by the idea, I seized the hairbrushes and looking at myself in the glass began to use them. Suddenly a hush fell upon the noise outside, and I heard the ports of my cabin were thrown open. I heard a deep calm voice, not on board my ship, however, hailing resolutely in English, but with a strong foreign twang, "Go ahead. There may be tides in the affairs of men which taken at the flood. Dot dot and so on. Personally I am still on the lookout for that important turn. I am, however, afraid that most of us are fated to flounder forever in the dead water of a pool whose shores are arid indeed. But I know that there are often in men's affairs unexpectedly even irrationally illuminating moments, when an otherwise insignificant sound, perhaps only some perfectly calm monplace gesture, suffices to reveal to us all the unreason, all the fatuous unreason, of our complacency. Oh, ahead are not particularly striking words, even when pronounced with a foreign accent, yet they petrified me in the very act of smiling at myself in the glass. And then, refusing to believe my ears, but already boiling with indignation, I ran out of the cabin and up on deck. It was incredibly true. It was perfectly true. I had no eyes for anything but the Diana. It was she, then, was being taken away. She was already out of her berth and shooting athwart the river. "He way this lunatic plucked that ship out as a caught iron," said the odd voice of my mate close to my ear. "Hey! Hallo! Falk! Herman! What's this infernal trick?" I yelled in a fury. Nobody heard me. Falk certainly could not hear me. His tug was turning at full speed away under the other bank. The wire hawser between her and the Diana, stretched as taut as a harp string, vibrated alarmingly. The high black craft careened over to the awful strain. A loud crack came out of her, followed by the tearing and splintering of wood. "Here," said the odd voice in my ear. "He's carried away their towing chock." And then, with enthusiasm, "Oh, look, look, sir, look at them Dutchmen skipping out of the way on the forecastle. I hope to goodness he'll break a few of their shins before he's done with them." I yelled my vain protests. The rays of the rising sun coursing level along the plain warmed my back, but I was hot enough with rage. I could not have believed that a simple towing operation could suggest so plainly the idea of abduction, of rape. Falk was simply running off with the Diana. The white tug careered out into the middle of the river. The red floats of her paddle wheels revolving with mad rapidity tore up the whole reach into foam. The Diana in midstream waltzed round with as much grace as an old barn, and flew after her ravisher. Through the ragged fog of smoke driving headlong upon the water I had a glimpse of Fox's square motionless shoulders under a white hat as big as a cartwheel, of his red face, his yellow staring eyes, his great beard. Instead of keeping a lookout ahead, he was deliberately turning his back on the river, to glare at his toe. The tall, heavy craft, never so used before in her life, seemed to have lost her senses. She took a wild sheer against her helm, and for a moment came straight at us, menacing and clumsy, like a runaway mountain. She piled up a streaming, hissing, boiling wave halfway up her blunt stem. My crew let out one great howl, and then we held our breaths. It was a near thing. But Falk had her. He had her in his clutch. I fancied I could hear the steel hawser ping as it surged across the Diana's forecastle, with the hands on board of her bolting away from it in all directions. It was a near thing. Herman, with his hair rumpled, in a snuffy flannel shirt and a pair of mustard-colored trousers, had rushed to help with the wheel. I saw his terrified round face. I saw his very teeth uncovered by a sort of ghastly fixed grin. And in a great leaping tumult of water between the two ships the Diana whisked past so close that I could have flung a hairbrush at his head, for, it seems, I had kept them in my hands all the time. Meanwhile Mrs. Herman sat placidly on the skylight, with a woolen shawl on her shoulders. The excellent woman in response to my indignant gesticulations fluttered a handkerchief, nodding and smiling in the kindest way imaginably. The boys, only half-dressed, were jumping about the poop in great glee, displaying their gaudy braces, and Lena in a short scarlet petticoat, with peaked elbows and thin bare arms, nursed the rag doll with devotion. The whole family passed before my sight, as if dragged across a scene of unparalleled violence. The last I saw was Herman's niece with the baby Herman in her arms standing apart from the others. Magnificent in her close-fitting print frock, she displayed something so commanding in the manifest perfection of her figure that the sun seemed to be rising for her alone. The flood of light brought out the opulence of her form and the vigor of her youth in a glorifying way. She went by perfectly motionless and as if lost in meditation. Only the hem of her skirt stirred in the draft. The sun rays broke on her sleek tawny hair. That bald-headed ruffian, Nicholas, was whacking her on the shoulder. I saw his tiny fat arm rise and fall in a workmanlike manner. And then the four cottage windows of the Diana came into view retreating swiftly down the river. The sashes were up, and one of the white calico curtains was fluttered straight out like a streamer above the agitated water of the wake. To be thus tricked out of one's turn was an unheard-of occurrence. In my agent's office, where I went to complain at once, they protested with apologies they couldn't understand how the mistake arose. But Schomburg, when I dropped in later to get some tiffin, though surprised to see me, was perfectly ready with an explanation. I found him seated at the end of a long narrow table, facing his wife, a scraggy little woman, with long ringlets and a blue tooth, who smiled abroad stupidly and looked frightened when you spoke to her. Between the malaglin punka fan 20 cane bottom chairs, and two rows of shiny plates, three Chinamen in white jackets loafed with napkins in their hands around that desolation. Schomburg's pet table d'hote was not much of a success that day. He was feeding himself ferociously, and seemed to overflow with bitterness. He began by ordering in a brutal voice the chops to be brought back for me, and turning in his chair. Mistake they told you? Not a bit of it. Don't you believe it for a moment, Captain. Falk isn't a man to make mistakes unless on purpose. His firm conviction was that Falk had been trying all along to curry favor on the cheap with Herman. On the cheap, mind you. It doesn't cost him a cent to put that insult upon you, and Captain Herman gets in a day ahead of your ship. Time's money, eh? You are very friendly with Captain Herman, I believe, but a man is bound to be pleased at any little advantage he may get. Captain Herman is a good businessman, and there's no such thing as a friend in business. Is there? He leaned forward and began to cast stealthy glances as usual. At Falk is, and always was, a miserably fellow. I would despise him. I muttered, grumpily, that I had no particular respect for Falk. I would despise him, he insisted, with an appearance of anxiety which would have amused me if I had not been fathoms deep in discontent. To a young man fairly conscientious, and as well-meaning as only the young man can be, the current ill usage of life comes with a peculiar cruelty. Youth that is fresh enough to believe in guilt, in innocence, and in itself, will always doubt whether it have not perchance deserved its fate. Somber of mind and without appetite, I struggled with the chop, while Mrs. Schomburg sat with her everlasting stupid grin and Schomburg's talk gathered way like a slide of rubbish. Let me tell you, it's all about that girl. I don't know what Captain Herman expects, but if he asked me, I could tell him something about Falk. He's a miserable fellow. That man is a perfect slave. That's what I call him. A slave. Last year I started this table d'hote and sent cards out, you know. You think he had one meal in the house? Give the thing a trial? Not once. He has got hold now of a Madras cook, a blamed fraud, that I hunted out of my cookhouse with a rattan. He was not fit to cook for white men. No, not for the white men's dogs either. But, see, any damn native that can boil a pot of rice is good enough for Mr. Falk. Rice and a little fish he buys for a few cents from the fishing boats outside is what he lives on. You would hardly credit it, eh? A white man too. Dot dot, he wiped his lips, using the napkin with indignation, and looking at me. It flashed through my mind in the midst of my depression, that if all the meat in the town was like these table d'hote chops, Falk wasn't so far wrong. I was on the point of saying this, but Schomburg's stare was intimidating. He's a vegetarian, perhaps, I murmured instead. He's a miser. A miserable miser, affirmed the hotel keeper with great force. He meat here is not so good, as at home of course. And dear too. But look at me. I only charge $1 for the tiffin, and $1.50 for the dinner. Show me anything cheaper. Why am I doing it? There's little profit in this game. Falk wouldn't look at it. I do it for the sake of a lot of young white fellows here that hadn't a place where they could get a decent meal and eat it decently in good company. There's first-rate company always at my table. The convinced way he surveyed the empty chairs made me feel as if I had intruded upon a tiffin of ghostly presences. A white man should eat like a white man, dash it all, he burst out impetuously. To eat meat, must eat meat. I manage to get meat for my patrons all the year round. Don't I? I am not circuiting for a damn lot of coolies. Have another chop, Captain. No? You, boy, take away. He threw himself back and waited grimly for the curry. The half-closed jalousies darkened the room pervaded by the smell of fresh whitewash. A swarm of flies buzzed and settled in turns, and poor Mrs. Schomburg's smile seemed to express the quintessence of all the imbecility that had ever spoken, had ever breathed, had ever been fed on infamous buffalo meat within these bare walls. Schomburg did not open his lips till he was ready to thrust there a spoonful of greasy rice. He rolled his eyes ridiculously before he swallowed the hot stuff, and only then broke out afresh. It is the most degrading thing. They take the dish up to the wheelhouse for him with a cover on it, and he shuts both the doors before he begins to eat. Fact. Must be ashamed of himself. Ask the N.I. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.